I was right, though.
But you didn't know.
You shot me down in the podcast, and I don't get a pointy stick, and it's not fucking fair.
Welcome to The Writer and the Critic, a monthly podcast devoted mostly to speculative fiction books, reviews, and the odd bit of idle gossip. I'm your co-host, Kirsten McDermott, and sitting next to me is Ian Mond. Good evening, Ian.
Good evening. 16 months in a row. Because this is 16.
We've not missed a month.
Yet. I'm not that I'm planning to. I mean, unless you're planning to ditch
me.
No,
I think missing months is bad.
I agree. My throat isn't 100%.
I can tell.
Why?
Because you just cacked up a lung then.
No, that was a little cough. You want me to do a big cough?
No, please continue.
So I apologise to the listeners in advance if they're not getting the same sexiness that they would normally get out of my voice, because I do have a very sexy voice. And I think that, it'd be a great shame that they're not getting it.
Moving along.
Really went nowhere. Also, I'm turning off my phone, Kirsten.
Yes, I did hear that buzz.
Yeah, that wouldn't have come out on the podcast.
No, it wouldn't have come out on the podcast, but if I hear the little did-it, you're in trouble.
No, I've turned off the sound. Can you just continue on while I'm turning off my
phone? Good evening, listeners. Good morning, wherever and whenever you may be listening to this podcast. We want to start tonight with a correction from Cheryl Morgan, who picked me up, on what we were saying about the Hugo Awards in relation to eligibility for Zoo City last podcast.
Well, more to the point, when Ian was saying the right thing.
You didn't know you were saying the right thing.
No, you had a pretty... I had a pretty confident voice.
So you were very easily led then.
Because you are intimidating.
I am, but you should stand your ground if you know you're right.
Well, from now on I will.
Okay.
I mean,
this could get very interesting.
No, because I'll tell you something. If I stand my ground, people will think that I'm, being sexist or something.
Why would they think that?
I don't know. I've heard negative reports about our first episode when I pick on you. People saying, well, that wasn't nice.
But I think I picked on you more, didn't I?
No, apparently I picked on you more.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but anyway, the point is that I was right.
The point is Ian was inadvertently right. So I'm going to just read an email that Cheryl Morgan sent to us in regards to eligibility for the Hugo Awards. And she begins mentioning the Clark Award because we had talked about that as well. So here's what Cheryl had to say. With the Clark Award, Tim Powers' Declare was only eligible last year because the Clark is only open to works published in the UK, so you were quite right about that one. But you compared that to the situation with The Quantum Thief and Zoo City. These books were eligible last year, and they're eligible again this year as a result of their first publication in America. In the Hugos, a work can get up to three chances. 1. On first publication. 2. On first publication in English, if the first publication was in another language, or 3, on first publication in the USA. Additional chances go away if you make the final ballot with an earlier one. The USA rule is an acknowledgement of the fact that the majority of Hugo voters are based in the USA, and they may not be able to obtain a book if it is not published there. It is renewed year on year rather than being a permanent fixture, precisely because it is expected that regional licensing will eventually be killed off by the internet, and thus the rule will no longer be necessary. More generally, regional restrictions on an award are not necessarily a bad thing. If the purpose of the award is to, say, promote Australian talented writers, then you might want to restrict it to works written by Australians. Things only get problematic if the award is promoted as being for the best work in English, but eligibility is restricted on a geographic basis, or if the award is theoretically open to works from all over the world, but the electorate is geographically restricted and typically only votes from works from the local region. The latter is the sort of issue that the Hugo rules are intended to counter. And I did not know that. I did not know.
You got schooled.
I got schooled. Thank you, Cheryl. No, I did not know that. I did not know that you had two chances if you're first published outside of the United States.
You listen to Coot Street and their Hugo special episodes, which have Cheryl and sometimes Kevin on, where they go through these rules.
Last episode was all about the new fan cast things and the encyclopedia of F and SF, and I just There's so many rules and so many awards and they all conflict and I get mixed up.
Did you buy a supporting membership for ShyCon?
No, that's also why I don't really care.
So you're not gonna vote?
I'm not gonna vote. Oh my god, I'm not gonna vote.
Well, why aren't you be part of the community? No, so I'm actually dead set on this. I'm not joking because I am. I bought a $50 supporting membership because I like to vote and I want to play my part and I want to know why you won't.
Well, I don't know. I just haven't had a chance.
It's really hard. Really busy. Seriously, that's your excuse?
That's my excuse.
That's bullshit. Why? There's an underlying reason here and I want to focus on it.
No, there's no reason. I can't be asked, actually. That's my reason.
Okay, I admit that.
When I was a member of AussieCon, yeah. I nominated and voted, and then I think I was able to nominate the next year as well, so I did that, and that's kind of it.
It's 15 minutes of your life. The Chicago 7
well, it's a lot more than 15
website
minutes,
Hugo nominating form is terrible. I mean, it's god awful because as I mentioned my blog, if you're putting the nominations in,
yeah.
And you then want to check to see how long a novella was, you click back to do that.
Yeah.
Assuming you don't go to a new tab, and then you click forward again, it's all gone.
Oh, see, I'd just quit. That would be I would just throw my hands up and go, forget it.
Yeah, well, it's Scheisenhausen. So, but I think as part of the dialogue, no, I'm not saying, look, admittedly, I want you to join up so you vote this thing, nominate
well,
us.
Well, I wouldn't nominate us anyway.
Why not? See, I don't get that. Every fucking person.
I will not nominate myself.
I want someone to write in. Who listens to this, someone tell me who doesn't nominate themselves. Everyone does.
Maybe I might nominate. I certainly wouldn't vote.
Really?
Yeah. Like I might nominate to.
So if Ryder and the Critic did get on the Hugo.
I wouldn't vote for us. No, you know my policy. My policy is if I am ever nominated in an award category, I don't vote in that category. Unless there, you know, there's something in there I think is really, really amazing and should like I just love and adore out of this world. But generally, I just leave that alone. I abstain from that category.
What moral bullshit is this?
I think it's a bit crass to vote for yourself.
But aren't you proud of the work you do?
Sure.
And therefore,
I'm not going to vote for myself.
I was uncomfortable with it as well. I quickly got over it. But okay, maybe you're right. Maybe this Hugo, I won't. Well, Ryder and the Critic's probably not going to appear on the shortlist. I won't say definitely not because you never know. We might have a groundswell, be one motherfucker at the groundswell. But I'm shooting the poo. Ryder and the Critic, I'll keep off my nomination. Will that make you feel better? You don't really care, do you?
You can do what you want. I'm not saying other people don't.
I want to know what other people think.
Oh, okay.
No, really,
feedback
I do.
Topic.
Well, yeah, possibly. And just to jump in, we have a new Twitter account. I know we were going to say that at the end, but
we'll say it again.
But we'll say it again. But we have so you can now comment on rather than write an email to us. You can comment on Twitter on Ryder and Critic. I'm the one controlling it, so you'll get responses from me. Kirsten doesn't bother with that sort of stuff. But
I think I've already used the phrase "can't be asked."
Yeah, well, you've already used it once. So I'm just thinking seriously. Who is it? Etiquette? What's the etiquette?
I don't know if there is etiquette. I would feel uncomfortable voting for myself. I think I am, in terms of my own work, I would be the absolute hands down least objective judge of my own work, and therefore, I really don't have any,
No one probably
authority to vote for myself.
No one probably has the figure. Well, maybe someone like Kevin Stanley does has the figures at their fingertips. But it'd be interesting to know how many authors don't. Not rather do, but don't nominate for their work. Nominate their works and or, once they're on the shortlist, nominate their book to win or vote for their book to win. That'd be fascinating because I think you're unique. Not entirely unique.
I don't think I'm entirely
really?
Unique.
Well, maybe Neil Gaiman doesn't. But then, you know.
Why do you pick Gaiman?
Well, no, I'm picking a very popular author who.
Who doesn't need to.
Correct. Correct.
Nothing to do with Mr. Gaiman's moral standing.
Correct. But for example, Seanan McGuire, who got very close last year.
With Feed.
With Feed, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Myra Grant.
I wonder if she voted for.
Yeah, I don't know. And I don't think it's fair to put anyone on the spot.
I just did. Was that not fair?
I don't think that was fair.
What's this got to do with what Cheryl had actually
I have
written?
No idea. I have no idea how we got down
this track.
It was
a great letter,
track.
Cheryl. Thank you very much.
Yes, no, thank you, Cheryl. Thank you for correcting me. I sincerely always do appreciate that. because I love the fact that the Hugos do have that second option for works published outside of the United States, considering, as Cheryl points out, the majority of Hugo voters are within the US and may not get to see other works until it gets published in the US.
Like Kim Westwood's book.
Zoo City.
Yeah, like Zoo City and like Kim Westwood's book, which I've already said I'm going to nominate for best novel, but is unlikely to be seen by more than...
I believe it's going to have a US publication within the next year to 18 months.
Really?
Yeah, either this year or next year.
As was pointed out by As was pointed out by someone on
sexist
Mark, I think it was Mark who said it on our poddy on our website.
Yeah,
I'm just checking. He's noted that it's actually available on Kindle. So that I know we haven't actually talked about.
Is it available on Kindle internationally?
Yeah, Amazon Kindle. You can buy it. So there's no excuse, but that doesn't change. I don't think that changes the boundaries because it's a physical copy that has to be published.
Oh, see, I don't know, and I'm not going to assume I know. Cheryl, let us know. It's a Kindle publication considered. No, see, I don't think – I'm going to go out on a limb and say I don't think it would be, because I would assume that that Kindle publication is still published by HarperCollins Australia. Okay. And it's just available internationally in the same way that this book would be available internationally if you jump online and buy it from a bookstore in Australia.
Except you're buying it off Amazon.com, which is not an Australian bookstore.
Yeah, I don't know. So I don't know.
Okay. All right, fair. Okay.
I think it's safe to say that e-books are changing the landscape in very many areas, including awards eligibility.
And again, we will talk about the book later, the actual content of the book. Yes. But it was lovely because I mentioned in the previous podcast how hard it was to buy a physical copy. On saying that, I just assumed it wasn't on Kindle, which was a big mistake because it was there and I could have just bought it off the Kindle. But it was nice to see that it was there, that an Australian book had made it. Is Madigan Mine on?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's available. Julia bought it, remember?
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
No, it's available. It's available. So we're going to move on from awards and stuff now.
That was the worst segue ever.
I'm tired.
Why?
I don't know. I haven't. It's really hot and I didn't sleep last night.
Yes, it's been 32 degrees for 2 days. What is that in Fahrenheit?
When it's hot.
88, it's 90 horrible. Degree Fahrenheit.
1,000 million degrees and you're just lying
Don't there. You have air conditioning here?
I've got an old air conditioner in my bedroom that makes the loudest. It sounds like a freight train going through your bedroom. So we don't have it on overnight. What are we talking about? We're moving on, people.
No, I'm really interested.
Shut up.
This idea of a freight train just running through your bedroom constantly. Yes, anyway.
Hello to my landlord. Okay, we got some feedback. We got a lot of feedback, but we got one specific bit of feedback.
But thank you, people, for giving us feedback for feedback.
And we will come to that again at the end of the show.
But isn't it nice of them?
It's lovely. It's really lovely. And particularly lovely was to get some feedback, which may have been awkward, but it wasn't because she's lovely. It was from Karen Lord.
Yes.
Who wrote us a really lengthy email following up on the discussion and some of the points we raised in the discussion of her book Redemption in Indigo on the last episode. And I just wanted to read out a fairly lengthy extract when she's talking about, because we were talking a bit about cultural appropriation and you made the comment of if you'd written the book, would it still be okay and so on. So I'm just going to read what Karen wrote to us on the topic. Your comments on cultural appropriation and respect were very important and welcome. My feelings were a bit mixed, and here's why. I chose that folktale to expand because out of all the ones from all over the world that I'd read, it was the one that felt most like home. And one of the reasons it felt like home is because the majority of my ancestors came from West Africa. Although language, religion, and names were taken away, a lot of West African culture has still survived in West Indian culture. I wrote The World of Redemption as a kind of Caribbean continent, a West Africa at one remove with no colonialism or slavery in its past. It's a wishful thought of how our world could have been without that societal trauma and dislocation. There's another important reason for my mixed feelings. The origins of the tale are not pure. What I read came by way of a 19th century German ethnologist and a 20th century translator and an author, reinterpreter, both white American, I think, or at least the writer. Can I trust that something was not lost during the first telling of the original tale to that German guy, and then in the translation from the German, and then in the reinterpretation of the entire tale for an American readership? I didn't trust it. I went back to the German original, but still only trusted myself to lean on those aspects which sounded the strongest echoes of my own culture. This folktale is mine, but it has been presented to me as alien by aliens. I have tried to reclaim it. However, I don't consider myself exempt from being cautious with these tales, no matter how familiar. Real-world stereotypes, half-truths and untruths are damaging even when set in a fictional world, and when it comes to the image and dignity of people in the here and now, and the narratives about themselves that they're forced to live with, the claim of heritage can only carry an author so far. On the other hand, Ian, you couldn't have written this book, because there's a lot of in-jokes that only West Indians and some West Africans will get. You might have been able to write it if you've lived here for about a decade or so, but I'm only teasing. Because for someone who claims to have no knowledge of my culture, you got so much out of it that I was impressed and honoured. Authenticity is in the universal, but it's also in the details. I think I can tell when an author is writing about something they know and love well, and I hope that's what people are seeing in my book. So thank you, Karen. That was very interesting feedback. And it actually was something I wanted, or touched on something I wanted to say to you last month when you brought up the thing, well, if Ian Maund had written the book, would it be cultural appropriation? As Karen said, you couldn't have.
Because of the in-jokes.
But the thing is, if you had, like if you'd written that book the way Karen had written it, would have meant you would have had to have done so much research and probably lived in the culture and talked to people, in which case...
Like, I wouldn't be, Ian Maund.
Well, you wouldn't be this Ian Maund, and you wouldn't, you know, it wouldn't be appropriation because, you know, like Karen, you are...
So it begs the question once again, how does a white bloke like me write about a culture like that without having to immerse myself in that culture for decades, years, whatever, and have best friends or even, in fact, have relatives, whatever, within that culture? How do you do it? How does anyone write the other? I'm sorry I come back to that question, but... No, but I think it's relevant. How do you do it?
Well, you don't write Redemption Indigo. You write a different book.
Well, but why can't I write Redemption Indigo?
Because you don't have you couldn't write it.
No, but here's the point.
What, Karen is saying.
Yeah, I get what Karen's saying, and thanks, Karen, for saying it. That's so patronising. I didn't mean it that way. No, what I'm saying is that let's say Ian was one of those writers who was confident enough in his own abilities that he could knock this novel out, which sounds like it's a bit of hack work, but it isn't. And what he's done, he's gone and spoken to his three or four African friends. He's even possibly bought a ticket to go safari hunting for a couple of weeks in South Africa or something. I've got family in South Africa,
this is
so you
sounding
know.
Really bad.
Yeah, I know. But he's gone, and in other words, what it would seem potentially someone like Paolo Bagigalupi did, very similar. Really, an expat, not even an expat experience. You've literally gone to the country for a few weeks. You've checked it out, yeah, okay. Picked up the odd in-joke and the odd bit of lingo, done a bit of your Wikipedia research. You've got two or three friends who are immersed in the culture, so you just make sure they check it, and you write Redemption in Indigo. Why not?
I don't see a reason why not.
But you just said I can't because I have to be immersed, I have to do this, I have to do that.
To have written that particular book.
I'm talking about that particular – It's a hypothetical here. Obviously, I'm not Karen Lord. I'm not going to write the exact words.
I don't think it's one of these things. It's a grey area again. And it's like, I mean, it's that cliched sort of thing, you know what it is when you see it. I mean, there's nothing to stop anyone doing it. Whether it succeeds is going to depend on how well you've done it, the respect you've shown, and all of that. And it's the proof's in the finished product, really.
I'm playing devil's advocate here a little bit because I agree with Karen.
Yeah.
It's very hard to do. And in fact, I don't see how anyone can do it really properly.
Yeah.
And that's why Race Fail existed, because there were people who said, yes, I can do it. And others saying, well, you're an arrogant prick and I don't think you can. I don't think that is. Well, actually, they did say things like that.
No, I think. Got even worse.
Yeah.
But that's the thing. I think the end result to a certain extent justifies the means. Does that make any sense? Like if the end result is good and it's recognized as being a good work and a respectful work and not a work that's exploiting a culture for commercial gain or whatever it is, then of course it's okay. So you can't, I don't think you can't set guidelines out to begin with. You've just got to let artists do what they do and judge the results. And when people stumble and make mistakes and fall down, the next people who come after them will learn, hopefully.
Yeah, okay.
I don't
want to get into the Courier's New Bicycle conversation now. But if the same issue applies, more with this than with the Silver Wind, the same issue applies, whether this is a book that Kim Westwood specifically could have written, there's no way I, as a white male, could have written that book in a gazillion years. I could have researched it till the cows come. I'd be offended if any white male – well, the white's actually got nothing to do with it.
Offended?
It's just white's – the colour of the skin isn't relevant. It says gender, cisgender, that has something to do with it. Any a heterosexual male could have written that book.
Well, we'll get to that.
I don't want to – it's a burning issue for me. You know, I know you're laughing, but I'm dead set fucking serious here. This is a issue because I don't get it. I don't. Karen, you didn't quote it in the letter, but she mentions the fact that I brought up the idea of Midrash,
yep,
which is Jewish fables, etc. Now, Midrash was very specific in that it was about giving a further depth to the Bible, to the stories within the Bible, not the stories, but the moral, sort of a moral story in from the Bible and from other things. So it's very culturally specific, very culturally. If Kirsten McDermott came along and wanted to do a book based around a few of the Midrashim, I personally would get upset, potentially.
Potentially.
Could be a brilliant book, but there is a very specific cultural thing going on here with Midrash. It's not just some funny stories that some rabbis wrote a few thousand years ago. There's actually some spiritual stuff going on there. There's some, and that's why it had a lot of resonance for me with Redemption in Indigo, because they also felt that spiritual element was running through Redemption in Indigo. It'd be tough to do it if you weren't, well, I don't know, Ian Mond would struggle to a degree.
Yeah.
Jewish.
But I think that, again, it's one of these things where you can't lay down laws and rules. You can't. You really can't. I'm sorry. That's what you want.
I'm not saying.
No, but you... Well, what are you saying?
I'm not saying that no one can do it. I'm saying I don't know how someone can do it. I actually don't know how physically their brains – it's not about the imagination here. It's not about the use of the imagination. I can think of a second world sort of medieval sort of cod bullshit and throw some interesting Asian-like characters in there and say, well, that's my own creation. It's about trying to get your mind into a completely different culture and understand that culture in and out. And I don't understand how someone could do that and pass it off and say, here, I've written this, aren't I good, if they're not of that culture.
Well, they're either going to be a very, very good writer or they're not going to do a good job. And that's it.
All right.
This is the thing. I mean, I know, but that's – I mean, there would be writers who are good enough to do that.
You've written two novels.
Not just to pull – you know, sit down at their desk one day and, I'm going to write a novel about the Midrash. But who've put in the research and so on.
You've written two novels?
Yes.
What are the main characters in terms of culture?
Well, they're Melbourneian. They're Australians. And they're more like my culture, really.
Because it's easier?
Yeah.
And if you were doing a third book tomorrow, would you think of doing Africans or Aboriginals? How about that? Koori culture. Would you be confident enough to do it?
Not right now, no.
But do you think you could one day?
If I did a whole lot of research.
Why is this question you feel like I'm putting you on the spot here? I'm not trying to put
you
on the
spot. No, I'm just saying, like, if I did a whole lot of research and stuff, then yeah, possibly. But not now, no. Because I don't have the research.
Okay.
But there's a whole lot of books I couldn't write that because I don't know enough about the subject and I haven't research how the characters would
be. But you don't feel immediately uncomfortable with just the concept of writing it. Assume the research is done and you do a lot of research and you go to we don't have reservations, but you go out to the Northern Territory or wherever and go – no, I'm serious.
Yeah.
You go around and take it all in for 6 months. You think you'd have the tools.
I could actually probably just talk to my aunt. But
yeah, that too. Family. Oh, I said family, whatever. Yeah. Do you think you'd have the writerly tools to pull it off?
I don't know. It would depend on the story. It would depend on why I felt I had to choose that particular culture to tell that story.
Wouldn't you be shit scared? I just couldn't do it. I couldn't get out of first gear.
But I'm shit scared of any novel.
No, I mean, but more so.
Yeah, I guess so. But I mean, it's yeah. I don't know. I think a work has to be written well, and I think there's harder books to write. When they are like the further removed a book gets from your own experiences and your own knowledge. And I don't mean, you know, knowledge that you've read in books or the internet, but the actual knowledge that you've taken to yourself through living for 20, 30, 40, 50 years. The further away that gets, the harder that is to write.
Okay.
But, you know, and to touch on the other thing that Karen said, when you're talking about writing, instead of something that's purely fantastical or made up, if you're talking about writing about a culture that is writing about real people, I mean, that's harder still because then you've got more confines in about reality, about respect and all of that sort of stuff. It would be really hard. And I think you need a good reason to write about different cultures. And I mean, that reason can be, you know, when I say a good reason, I mean, you need a good story.
Yep.
And I think you do need a level of passion and interest and fascination and respect for whatever culture you're writing about.
And you just hit it on.
And if you do all that and you're a good writer and you write a good book, I don't think it matters if you're not in that culture.
Okay.
But it's not going to be the same book as someone who comes from that culture.
I agree.
And you shouldn't pretend it is.
I agree. And that was, there you go. That was my thing. That, and before people start screaming and say, Mondi, get over this and move on, which I will, but just that during Race Fail, there were a bunch of very arrogant authors, well-named very arrogant authors, who felt they could just do it. And they had the right to do it and they could, you know, yeah, respect whatever, but, you know, fuck on 10% this, that and the other, so I have every right to write this story and all that sort of shit. And what you've said it with a lot of qualifiers and, you know, conditions need to be met. Whereas the whole problem with the Race Fail was a whole lot of authors didn't feel that they needed to meet any real conditions other than the fact that they had confidence in their own abilities and that was enough. That was the biggest problem I had. That's not entirely – that's one paragraph of Karen Lord's letter. what I actually found interesting – just to move on because
– slightly.
Every time Karen Lord writes something, we talk about other stuff around what she's written. It's amazing. But do you know what's interesting about that? This idea that she was in a sense reclaiming a story that came from German – in a sense, a German source, and wasn't of her own culture either. Yeah. So that in itself is really interesting. But because she's much closer to the original source, it's easier for her, whereas for me it would be near impossible. I get that. I agree. I understand.
Yeah.
I do understand that.
And you've,
I think there are some authors out there who would think she's wrong and say, no, fuck, I could do it.
Possibly. And they might be right. I don't know. I mean, there's also the further complication when you're talking about, people's culture and writing outside your culture is, you know, we do have such a osmosis of cultures.
Good word.
If you grew up reading fairy tales as Karen did from, you know, and she's talking about this specific one that she was talking about from West Africa. But I still love fairy tales. And when I was, you know, up to the age, you know, from when I began reading and looking at books up to the age of 12 or whatever, I read fairy tales and mythology from everywhere. I mean, it's very much formed a part of who I am. And that's not saying that I feel part Chinese because I've read a lot of Chinese fairy tales, or I feel part Russian because I've read a lot of fairy tales. But those stories have formed a very real component of who I am as a person, as a writer, as a part of a broader culture. So to put certain things aside as an adult and say, now that I'm grown up and I realise all those fairy tales that I loved were actually Chinese, I can't use them because they're not – but they are part of my culture. They actually are. What I have to do is recognise
that – we're treading here.
No, what I have to do is recognise that, A, I read them in an English translation and an adaptation, and I haven't gone back and read the original Chinese ones, and that the culture that has formed part of me is a second, third hand one. And that's what it is. It's not the same as saying, I know Chinese culture because I've read a few fairy tales translated into English.
I think you saved yourself there. No, because...
but that's what I'm saying.
But it's part of your culture is very...
No.
You have to unpack that.
Those fairy tales that I've read have formed part of my personal culture.
Part
but
of
that
your...
is not
personal experience is more than culture.
Well, okay, by culture I mean I guess I'm not talking about a broader community type.
I read a lot of Ina Blyton. I don't see myself as a young English boy or girl.
No, I don't see but those stories have formed part of who I am.
Yeah, all right.
So it's a complicated issue. Yeah, I know.
Maybe we need someone who's more of an expert on this. Not to say that you aren't, because
no,
you're
I'm not.
It, but someone who's got more knowledge on this. One day, get them on the podcast.
But that's it. But I mean, the thing is that when you have parts of other cultures that have formed part of you and your own personal, who you are, your own identity. What you have to recognize, as Karen Lord recognized with that email, is that you go back to the source, and you don't try and pretend that there's an authenticity beyond what you actually got.
Yeah.
Okay. But that doesn't necessarily mean you need to throw off all this stuff and try to strip yourself down to, I don't know what exactly.
Can I tell you something?
Yes.
About Kim Westwood.
Are we moving on?
We will in a sec, but just talking about authenticity in that.
Yes.
There's a scene in the book where there's an ambulance.
Yes.
And I realise, and the paramedics come out and do their thing, I realise that I can't be a writer because I've got no idea how that works. it just occurred to me. I don't know. If I did a scene with an ambulance.
That's when you do research.
Yeah, but I hate research.
Then you can't be a writer.
Yeah, see, that's exactly what
I'm saying.
Sorry. That's the conclusion I came to. And that's a really good segue into a completely different book.
Okay.
Which is The Silver Wind by Nina Allen.
Actually, wait. What? Before we do, there was one more thing I wanted to say at the beginning of the podcast, talking about our ebook.
Oh, yeah, the ebook extravaganza.
Oh, it's got a name now.
Yeah, well, it does now.
Last month we asked people to recommend good self-published original ebooks.
Yes, we did.
That we could overview and select from, and hopefully have a special podcast later in the year looking at 4 or 5 books.
Flooded with emails.
How many do we get, Ian?
One.
We got one.
We won't say who, but
so but we are serious about this. But you know, if we don't get the recommendations, like if people out there haven't found or come
across,
it's
possible they're not actually reading this stuff.
Yeah, it's possible. Then we won't do it, obviously, and we'll just have to come up with a couple of books ourselves.
Should we open this up to the authors themselves?
Maybe. I don't know. That's a bit dangerous.
Well, I think we can, as long as the authors know that we will shit on their books if they're shit. I mean, I'm not going to literally
take. You may just not read that.
No,
I
won't literally take my iPad out, turn on the Kindle app, and defecate on
it.
Okay. I'm saying that we just won't. No. Well, that's
anyway.
What?
So
I thought that was a perfectly civil thing to say about my iPad.
Okay. So what I thought we'd do is I've gone through a whole bunch of books that I have here, and pulled out ones that we've talked about on the podcast before. And so if we get 5 ebooks that we talk about on the podcast, we'll send one of these books to the recommender, the person who recommended it.
The recommendee?
No, we would be the recommendees.
Are we?
Yes.
Okay.
So the books we're giving away, is Zoo City by Lauren Burkus, The 100,000 Kingdoms by N.K. Jemisin, The Tiger's Wife by Taya Obrett, Boulder's Love by Gwyneth Jones, which happens to be a hardcover edition, and The Business of Death by Trent Jamison, which is actually the omnibus, which includes the first Deathworks book that we actually talked about on the podcast, but you will get the whole omnibus of 3. So recommend us ebooks, and I guess if you're an author, you can recommend us the books too, but
anyway. Look, I don't know how many people exactly listen to our podcast.
We may step
on
feet.
There's a few hundred.
And yes, and if we
And if my Twitter feed is anything to go by, there's all these Kindle books out there that people are saying, read mine. Apparently no one reads the fucking things.
Well, I would like to read some good ones. I would. I would like to get inside the indie publishing world and see what's out there. But we want good ones because you know how harsh we can be, people. We can be harsh.
Wait till we get to Nina Allen.
Oh!
No, I'm kidding, Nina, because I recommended the book and I love The Silver Wind.
You just gave her a heart attack there.
Yeah, I know. I recommended it and I loved it.
So yes, and if we pick the book that you recommend, we'll be in touch and we'll send you out a copy of one of those 5 novels. Sounds good?
Yeah.
And if we get no recommendations, I guess all the self-published indie ebooks out there are not worth talking about.
Well, that's the conclusion I'm going to draw based on our listenership, because obviously we, cover the whole world.
So send us recommendations, people. We'll give you the contacts again at the end of the podcast.
I'd actually be interested, again, via Twitter. It doesn't have to be via email. Yeah. For people to, no, they can recommend that way as well.
Absolutely.
But also people to actually write and say, I actually don't read ebooks, these self-published ebooks, and there's no way. I'd actually like to see that too.
Okay. Feedback about ebooks.
Yeah.
Indie self-published ebooks.
Just send something to
general.
The writer or critic Twitter feed saying,
and remember,
know,
we don't.
I
we
would
don't
never
want
read these.
Our exclusions are we actually don't want ebooks by established authors. We want new self-publishing authors who haven't been established in traditional publishing and are now publishing new work or backlists. That's what we want to see. We want to see if. Okay, yeah. we're definitely moving on.
Now moving on, The Silver Wind by Nina Allen. Now Nina, this is the first I came across. Her work, but apparently she's been writing quite a bit for, well, specifically the Interzone is probably the most prevalent SFNL magazine she's been writing for. But reading some of the reviews of her work, people are familiar with her work. This is the first taste I'd ever had.
Yeah, me
of
too.
Of her
me
stuff.
Too.
So The Silver Wind comprises five short stories, which are all linked, though I would debate the fifth one.
Yeah, which is why that's more of an afterword, as it says.
Yes, it does.
Yeah.
And it's four short stories. I think it's called Disrupted Time. Is that right? Time Disrupted. Four stories of Time Disrupted.
Oh, right. Sorry.
Yes.
Yep.
They all feature the same characters. Well, variations of those characters.
The same names.
Same
name.
Well, yeah, variations of the same sort of character with the same.
The same names.
Okay. They feature variations of the same names. No, that doesn't make sense either. They feature the same names, which are variations of characters. From previous stories.
Yeah.
Sort of.
Sort of.
Yes.
It's hard to explain.
It's really
without
that type of book.
Yeah.
Without spoiling it? Well, we're going
to. Not without spoiling it, but it's hard to explain in a sentence.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And it's all about, what's the clever word for clocks? Horology, is that it?
I don't know.
I'm a Doctor Who fan. You'd think I'd know.
I think you would know.
I think it's horology or chronology or something like that.
Chronology is referring to time.
Yeah, but horology is a love of clocks.
Okay.
So if you were checking this up, like Jonathan does on Coos Street on the internet.
Then we'd have dropouts in the audio.
Oh. Well, that'd be bad. So, look, I read all four. I read the whole book. Now, this is what's interesting about this.
I hope you would read
that. Yeah, no. Sorry, that was not well
said.
So
did I.
What's interesting is that The Silver Wind, the novella-ish, that's about a novella, yeah,
yep.
That forms the heart of the collection, is actually being nominated as it's on its own, because it was published originally in Interzone,
yep,
for the British Science Fiction Award, the BSFA. And, you know, it's been talked about potentially being nominated for a Hugo. In fact, it's on my nomination list.
Yep.
But. I say.
Dun, 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 dun.
I read it, having read the previous two stories, because I was reading
it
in the form of a collection. And I would probably argue that if I read it on its own, I don't know if it would have resonated as strongly as it did.
I don't think if I'd read any one of these four stories on the, well, five, but really, if you hadn't read the fifth one, yeah. But I don't know if I'd read any of them on their own. As you say, it wouldn't have the depth.
Yeah, correct.
The
first two also were published separately.
Yeah.
The first one you could probably read on its own.
Yeah, because you've got nothing else to be going on with.
Yeah. The second and third, you sort of go, well, you actually need the feedback from the first.
To make them – not to make them work, but to add that extra richness to them.
Yeah.
Because you are crossing characters over. I mean, they all of the four stories I'm just going to leave the fifth aside because it's quite different to the others and kind of just tangentially sort of.
I'm glad it comes at the end, but I'm not sure it actually needed to be in the
book. I didn't think it needed to be in the book. But anyway, and it's called a collection of four stories, so I'm just going to look at those four. So all four of them have a character called Martin as their protagonist. But Martin differs from story to story and his relationships with people differ. So in the first story, which is Time's Chariot, is that?
Yes.
Yep. It's mainly about Martin and his incestuous relationship with his sister Dora. And then in another story, Dora she's just a passing character. In another one, she is, in My Brother's Keeper, his...
Yeah, My Brother's Keeper is the second story.
Yeah.
And Dora is... Well, it's more about this character called Stephen.
Yeah, who is Martin's brother.
Dead brother.
Yeah. Whereas in the first story, Dora is his sister and it's Dora who dies.
Yes.
And in the second story, Martin doesn't have a sister. He has a brother who's died.
And in the third story, Dora is a confidant.
Yes, she's a friend. Sort of a... Yeah, not really a close friend, just a...
And in Rewind, the fourth story, Dora, again, is his sister who died.
But died well before the story.
Yes.
Yeah. So it's odd. So you have characters with the same names, and then you've got Andrew Owens or Owen Andrews, who's the clockmaker. He appears
basically
throughout the stories.
You could say dwarf? Is that
he's a dwarf.
Little person, yeah.
And he appears throughout the stories in different manifestations. And you find out by the Silver Wind that he's actually the one probably creating the time effects with his machines, his time machines.
Yeah, I mean.
But you come across him before you know that. In the first story, he's just like a character on the beach. The circus man is what Dora calls him.
Yeah.
And he's just this little minor character who Martin and his sister remember from when they were young and
vaguely
they went to the
creepy.
Seaside. Well, Martin didn't find him. Creepy Dora found him a bit creepy.
And in the second one, he also is only a minor character, but towards the end, Martin falls over or scratch. You know, he gets a watch.
Yeah, he repairs it. Yeah, then he's featured in the Silver Wind. He's the watchmaker who Martin tracks down.
Yes.
So you have these characters who shift around.
And the fourth story, he's there as well.
Yeah.
In a very interesting way.
Yeah. So you have characters who shift around themselves, but Martin's the protagonist in each story of these four.
So Martin Lewis, not Martin Newland, who is the main character of this story, of the Martin Lewis, who is a reviewer.
Right. Yeah. Good,
a very good reviewer, reviewed The Silver Wind because it's nominated part of the BSFA. And he didn't like it.
Just the story.
Just The Silver Wind. And he said that one of the reasons why he didn't like it was because Martin himself, not Martin the reviewer, Martin the character,
yes,
is a colourless, dull protagonist. He also didn't like the fact that he basically pops up into another world and becomes a real estate agent and his credit card works. And he didn't like some of those things as well. But his main issue was that you had this colourless character who you had to follow, who he found had no interest in. But when I'm reading The Silver Wind, I've read the other two
stories.
You've
read the other two Martins.
And this Martin is a different Martin in my head than it would have been for Mr. Lewis. I'm not going to call him Martin because it's just going to get so confusing. Mr. Lewis's. And in fact, the comments to his review of the story have people who've read the whole book saying it's different when you read.
Which is
the
interesting
book.
Considering it's that novella that's been nominated and not the collection.
Yes, correct.
Yeah. I don't know because having read it as a collection, obviously it's near impossible to be able to tease out how you would react to each story if you'd come across them completely on their own without knowledge of the others. I don't think it would have had the resonance. That was the word you used. That's a good word. Because the stories and the whole meaning of The Silver Wind, the idea that there is time travel, but it goes – actually, you know, I'm going to read out a quote from Owen Andrews, who's the time bridge inventor from The Silver Wind, the story, who Martin tracks down because Martin's trying to find a way to his wife has died, Miranda.
Yes.
And he's trying to find a way to bring her back to life.
Miranda also appears in...
But as another character.
Yeah, in another...
But anyway, and so he's trying to... He has this idea that Andrew Owens can use time to maybe send him back to Miranda or so on. And here's what Owens... Sorry, Andrews, because in this story he's Owen Andrews, not Andrew Owens.
People get the idea this is a tad confusing, but...
So here's what Andrew explains the way time works. He says it's time is not like a thread, but it's like an amorphous mass, a rag bag, if you like, the rag bag of history. The time stasis might grant you access to what you think of as the past, but it wouldn't be the past that you remember. You wouldn't be the same and neither would she. It would be like that feeling you get when you meet someone at a party and can't remember their name. You know them from somewhere, but you can't for the life of you think where from. And that pretty much encapsulates what's happening in this series of stories.
It's the reader's experience.
The reader is the only one in the stories who's actually able to view the way time is being used and the way the characters are occurring as they are possibly using Owens's, Andrews's, time bridge.
And I thought that was, frankly, brilliant.
Yeah, really, really good. Writing, but you don't get any of that from any one of the stories.
No, it's only the feeling that you get after reading them.
I mean, The Silver Wind, the story has some of it because you do have Martin slipping into a different time
stream. It's the most expository of the story. Got all the – I mean, it's very much a Stephen Moffat sort of
– You get much more of an effect from reading the collection as a whole because you see them become without any knowledge that there's another Martin in another world, being another story in this case, and there's another Dora and there's another Miranda and there's another none of these characters within their own story have any idea, whereas the Martin from The Silver Wind does, like when he does the time slip thing, he does remember being the other Martin. So within that story he maintains his personality.
His Martinness.
His Martinness. That's nice. but yeah, so the reader is really the only, I guess, participant in this collection who gets to see the whole as it's been written, which is really quite clever.
It's the writing is gorgeous.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
And beguiling. Because I was reading that first story and at the Times Chariot, and there isn't much of a story to it. It's really a relationship between a brother and a sister and the incestuous thing, which you get that prickly sensation. I don't know how you feel when you're reading a story that's going to be about incest, but I get a certain feeling.
Okay.
Even when the incest hasn't been mentioned.
In your pants?
I do not get a – no, Kirsten. I get a prickly sensation in my – not nether region, but just generally. And I just feel this is going down the incest route, isn't it? There's incest coming. I feel incest. Genuine incest on its way. That's how I generally feel. And there was. Seriously, I was, again, reading it in the cafe at work. And I just got the incest vibe, and it wasn't the food I was eating. That usually gives me another problem.
Well, she flags it pretty early on in the story.
No!
There's an intimacy. There's an intimate gesture that's a bit too intimate.
That was probably where I got the prickles.
Yeah.
But you could easily have also just assumed that was just the way they were.
It was awkwardly intimate for that brother-sister.
Okay.
The way she phrased it, I'd have to look and find it again, but that's what it was. I mean, that's the skill of her writing.
Yes, because
she convey that this particular intimate gesture was just a bit too intimate, even for brother and sister.
The story isn't genre really at all.
No, not really.
There's sort of the creepy element of
that. There's a bit of a ghost thing at the end.
Yeah, but it's ephemeral, the ghost.
Which kind of, I guess, flows into the second story where the brother really is a ghost.
But again, that story was published all on its own.
Yeah.
So I do wonder how people read that sort of end with the ghostly sort of manifestation. But anyway, there's that. But it is really just a story about a brother and a sister and the incest part, and yet so beautifully written and such an economy of words, and you're just drawn into it. And even though Martin isn't a particularly interesting character, because he isn't, he's actually never, just to tell Mr. Lewis, Martin is never an interesting character. He's pretty uninteresting. And in fact, by the fourth story, he's so socially insecure and awkward, it's actually very hard to read it in some ways. But there's something about her writing.
I like the fourth story. I think that might be my favourite.
That's my favourite, actually, as well. Yeah. But there's something so beguiling about the writing that
But see, it might only be my favourite because I've read the other three.
Yeah.
You know, like I may not love it so much if I hadn't read the other three stories.
There's something very smart going on here.
Yeah.
In each story, she's building on, to mostly Martin, giving them a much happier ending. Because if you look at the first one, he basically ends with his dead sister and he's a wreck. In the second one, his watch gets fixed, but he's still got a dead brother.
Yep.
In the third one, he's got a dead wife, but he has a much better life because he becomes a real estate. He becomes a real estate agent.
Yeah.
And in the fourth one, Martin's able to tie his life together. I mean, he meets Miranda, a different version of Miranda, but he falls in love with her. They have awkward sex.
They're very awkward.
Which reminded me a lot of Rob Sherman. Having awkward sex with Rob Schumann, just his writing, because he also writes awkward sex.
In your pants?
I'm not talking about that, and I don't mean to bring him up in another podcast, but just it did resonate to me. But there's a more sense of self for Martin by the end of that. He's come, because again, the incest thing has come full circle in that story, and he's now out with it. And
But that's it. If you hadn't had those first three, that fourth story wouldn't have all that emotional impact.
Correct. That's why it's such a smart.
That's the original story to the collection. Is that?
Yes.
Am I correct?
Yep. Yes.
And then the afterward.
I think the afterward is also original. Yeah. So the way they. I'm sorry, I'm enamored by this collection. I know The Silver Wind on its own possibly doesn't work for everyone, but The Silver Wind, a collection,
it's
is
really
an
good.
Astonishing piece of
it's
writing.
It's really good.
Come on, say you're a criticism so I can defend the book.
No, I don't have any concrete – I really don't actually like have any specific criticisms of the book. I just – I didn't have the depths of an emotional connection that you obviously did to Martin and the stories. I really liked Andrew Owens, Owen Andrews. He was probably my favourite character. I loved him. He was great. And I loved his story, The Silver Wind.
But he's the enigmatic, really mysterious character that you can't...
No, he gets a lot in The Silver Wind.
He gets a big chunk of the scene in the middle of that story, but basically isn't at the end and isn't at the beginning.
Mm.
And he's... but he's purely... and he gets a little chunk towards the end of the fourth story.
Yeah, yeah.
But he's purely that enigmatic character. If you overplay him, then it just becomes expository city, and that's not what she's trying to do. Look, Martin is not a particularly interesting human being. And yet we get to see how he weirdly develops, even though he's completely different people while he's doing it.
Yeah. I mean, look, it's a really – and I enjoyed reading it, and I'm definitely interested in reading more of Nina Allen's work. I think she's a very accomplished short story writer.
But. Well, of course there's a but to this.
Stop
there's
it.
A, there is. I'm sorry.
You're just horrible.
I'm horrible.
No, I was just – I found a review on Strange Horizons by Sophia Samatar. I think that's how you pronounce her name. Sorry, Sophia, if that's incorrect. I'm just going to read a little bit of it because actually I read this and went, yeah, that kind of crystallizes my thoughts about it. She says, the emotional distance created with the appearance of each new Martin may be a deliberate effect. If not deliberate, it may be unavoidable. A necessary outcome of Allen's project, the reflection in the reader's psyche of the disjunctions that make up the structure of the book. And then she quotes from the introduction, and she's sort of saying that there's certainly an intellectual pleasure to be found in reading timelines and afterward. Sorry, I'm just skipping ahead, but... she's talking in terms of the emotional resonance, the conclusion of timelines and therefore of the Silver Wind itself as a whole is less satisfying than the end of Rewind.
Yeah, but I think we said 10 minutes ago
but it's
that fifth story is probably a bit of a letdown.
Yeah, it's sort of – it is. And maybe if it had just finished with Rewind –
Oh, I agree with you.
That would have
no. I agree with
but,
you.
Yeah, because maybe the addition of timelines at the end it did. Yeah, I don't know. I just didn't feel that depth of connection by the end of the book.
No, the important point that I think that Sophia says, which I think is what you were leading to.
Yeah.
But if you weren't, well, too bad. Is it in terms of this emotional distance? This may be a statement on a philosophical level. But
well, she's talking about how Martin disappeared because Martin's not in the fifth story.
Yeah, but it's only one that can be made by sacrificing to some extent the reader's engagement with the book.
Yeah. And I think that's what happened to me.
So you actually, what, because of timelines and afterward, you...
Well, that probably cemented it. Like if it had just finished with Rewind, I think it would have been there. But having that that shorter piece afterwards, I would have much preferred the book, I think, without it.
Yeah, look...
Because I think the four stories work really well as a suite.
I agree.
And it's almost... There is a dissonance in... distancing mechanism in that last
well it's a
story.
Lot more meta it's playing sort of fictive sort of thing
without really explaining anything which you wouldn't want but it's just a bit too arch maybe I don't know
it's the most pretentious story and let's be frank it's the most pretentious story in the collection and it, look but that doesn't ruin it for me because I was already I there was a bit of a break between me reading the last fourth story and the fifth story, and I was
I read the whole collection. That's not true. I read the first two, and then I read the last three. So two sittings.
Yeah, and that. So if you're going to read it, just have a gap between story four and five.
Leave the last one.
Well, yeah,
for a while.
I'd be interested to know from Nina why the fifth story's in there and what she was trying to do, just from that perspective. But I like this idea of that Sophia mentions that the game that that Nina's playing, which is to break. To take the Martin you've just become used to and potentially fallen in love with. Although it's very hard with Martin.
I didn't fall in love with him.
But you've gotten used to him and go, okay, well, this is Martin, and chuck you into another Martin. You go, oh, I'm going to get used to this one.
And she flags it.
And you still find that there's a thread between them all.
But it's really good the way she's flagged it really early on in the story by swapping out which watch he gets given first. So in one story, the story opens with, you know, he's given this watch for his birthday. And the next story, he's still given a watch, but it's a different watch. Yeah. So it's no longer, like, his first watch is no longer this brand. It's now this other watch. So she flags that really early on in the second story that things are going to have been switched
around. And did you know that the fourth story has two viewpoint characters? It's the only one that
does. Yeah, it's got Miranda as a viewpoint character.
Yeah, which was interesting as well. I don't know why, but it was.
And maybe that's why I like that story more as well, because she's... Because
a woman gets a voice?
Not just a woman, but her character is a more enjoyable character to see the world through than Martin.
Yeah,
Martin's very academic and standoffish. And
if you met Martin, you probably wouldn't want to meet him again. In the first story especially, he's a bit of a cock. And the second one, he's a kid. He's only a young boy. In the third one... he's just an obsessive, so you wouldn't want to be in the same room with him. And the fourth one, if he was any more socially awkward, you'd probably just shoot him in the head. So, but that's my point. There's a lot of times when writers try and do that sort of character and they don't get away with it, and I think Nina Allen does.
Oh, I think so.
Unfortunately, if you just read The Silver Wind, you probably would just go, why? I don't like this person. Keep him away. Yuck. Yuck.
Yeah, and look, I don't have to love a protagonist to like a story. I mean, look, we had that talk about Embassy Town, and you didn't like
Avis
at all. And I didn't like her in the sense of a person who I'd love to hang around with, but I liked her as a character, and a lot of what I liked about her was that she was spiky and distant.
See, to me, that's an example of getting it wrong.
Oh no!
Because Avis is so dull.
I didn't think she was dull. I thought, but she was just spiky and she had a lot of armor she was carrying around with her. But what I'm saying is, I don't have to love the main character to love the story. I just thought, Martin's character is a little. I mean, the Martin Lewis reviewer you were saying he was bland. I don't know that I'd go so far as to say bland.
Bland was the exact word he used.
But
colourless, I think, was definitely a...
Colourless would be a better word.
And he's a good reviewer, so that's probably what he would say.
But, I love the second viewpoint in that last story, just maybe because it was a bit of a break from Martin. Because Martin's voice
He says, Martin is a grey man in a colourless world, and I found little intellectually to hold my interest in the absence of anything more visceral. It is only after much treading of water that the story bows to the inevitable, and Martin utilises the Silver Wind, which is the time bridge.
Yep.
When this happens, he slides into another time stream, chaotic and troubled, but no longer fascistic. Bloody, bloody, blah. And then he picks up the point, Martin Lewis, that is, picks up the point that how he effortlessly integrates himself into this world, which does strain credulity a little bit, which I sort of agree with. But, again, it sort of works in the context of the whole
collection. In the context of the whole collection.
But the problem I have with the Silver Wind is that padding bit in the forest, which annoyed me.
Oh, yeah, when he's running lost.
That's the only thing in the whole book that I thought, why I don't get this. Why is he running around? He's just been told by Andrew Owen, whichever variation on the name.
Yeah.
That don't go into the forest because there's mutants in the forest. And he ends up, to get away from a couple of sentries, he ends up going to the forest.
And really deep into the forest.
His intention is to stay on the very verge, but he ends up getting very deep. How fucking stupid do you have to be? I mean, seriously.
Yeah.
And gets chased by a mutant.
Yeah.
And you think, that's...
kind of got warned about that.
Yeah. And it just felt like an action scene for the sake of an action scene as well, and a bit of tension for the sake of it. The book hadn't... The rest of the stories weren't like that. But aside from that, I love this.
Excellent.
I love it. Do you love it?
I like it very much.
Do you love it though?
No, I don't love it. I like it very much. And I think she's a fine short story writer, and I'd like to read more of her work.
Yes, so would I. And I don't think it's available as an e-book. Probably is now that I've just said that. But you can definitely got to get off Book Depository, which I said before.
Or direct from the publisher's website, I think.
I don't particularly like the cover or the internals. Mm. And I think that's one of the shames, that the cover is...
Yeah, the cover's not...
It's dull.
Wonderful.
It's really dull. Say. I'm sorry, Nina, but your writing, because it's gorgeous, deserves a better cover. Not that a cover makes a book. I mean, you know,
no,
we thought
but
that
a cover...
grade one.
was going to make the difference between something picking up a book or not in a bookstore. If there are any bookstores left, maybe covers don't matter anymore.
Yeah,
after
possibly.
All.
I mean, but that said, Ebenvale, who are the publishers, good on them for publishing her because this is great stuff and highly worth reading. And I look forward to more stuff by Nina Allen.
Definitely, I'm going to hunt up some more short fiction.
Apparently, she's got another collection coming out.
Yes, I'm looking forward to it.
Yes, and we might even do it on this show, or not. I don't know. Should we be making these promises?
Probably not.
Yeah, well, anyway.
So many books.
So, yep, highly recommended, Silverwind.
Excellent. Right. Now.
Your book.
We're making my book.
Your shit. No, it's brilliant.
Oh, God, you're just so horrible.
Well, I made fun of Nina's book and I thought
awful.
Kim's probably not going to listen to this podcast, though.
You're so awful.
She might.
Anyway, the next book that I recommended because I read and loved very much is The Courier's New Bicycle by Kim Westwood. This is her second novel. Her first novel was called The Daughters of Moab, and that came out, I think, 2008. I'm not exactly sure, but and I did read it. I didn't like it as much. But The Courier's New Bicycle, I thought, was a very good book and quite a different style for what I'm used to Kim Westwood's writing as being,
it's pared back.
It's very pared back. It's a sort of a noir voice. It's essentially a crime thriller.
Yes.
But that's not the most interesting thing about the book. I mean, it's a good little mystery. Like it pulls you through the story. The plot pulls you through.
Yeah.
But, you know, the really interesting stuff about the book is more to do with the setting and the world and the characters. And you've got this plot that they all hang around, which is great, but it's not the plot, which is, makes this such an astonishing book.
Oh, that was all we have to say on that.
You're such an idiot.
Well, you just said the way you ended that, and there's an astonishing book, and what else is there to say?
I'm going to read the back of this book just to give people an idea of what it's about. Salisbury Forth is a courier of contraband in the alleyways of inner Melbourne, a city of fuel rationing, rolling power outages and curfews. It's a stressful life post-pandemic. A vaccine dispensed Australia-wide is causing mass infertility and the government has banned all remedies except prayer. Vigilantes prowl for transgressors while the pious gather like moths under the streetlights at dusk. Then someone starts trading tainted hormones on the boss's patch. Salisbury must find whoever is trying to destroy the business before everything goes belly up. And what you might notice about that blurb is the lack of pronouns.
Yes, I did notice that.
And this is going to be a very interesting book to talk about from a practical verbal
standpoint. No, I'm going to apologise. I'm probably going to say she a lot, and I don't mean it, but it's just
this is a book that, inherent that, prejudice on that my part. Makes me bemoan yet again the lack of gender-neutral pronouns in the English language because we don't have them. We have the very awkward they-them.
Here.
But it doesn't.
Here.
What?
H-I-R.
Oh, well, we have alternates proposed, but none of them have taken off in any sort of...
How do you expect them to take off in the sort of society we live in?
Well, exactly.
Where gay marriage can't even get a foothold. How do you expect gender-neutral pronouns to make
a... Well, gay marriage is getting a foothold in quite a few places, actually. Europe, quite a few. No, it's getting there.
Yeah, okay, so maybe in a century we'll have a gender-neutral...
Might be nice. But it is, I mean, it is a failing of the English language that we don't have a gender-neutral pronoun. I mean, we have recent use of they and them, but that doesn't tend to work when discussing a specific person, only when discussing people in a more general sense. Like, I went to the doctor, what did they say? But if you say, you know, I went and saw my aunt, what did they say? It sounds quite wrong.
Kirsten, can you help me?
What?
Not psychologically, although, you know.
So any...
Because on that, how did you visualise Salisbury?
Very androgynous looking, as she says repeatedly. I mean, Sal, we're never as is appropriate, I guess, because she's quite a private person. Whenever given a exact details of her physiology, we do know that Sal was raised as a girl by her family.
Now that, stop there. Mm. Raised as a girl by her family, does that mean she has a vag? No. Sorry, I didn't mean to say that.
That is so crass.
No, it is crass. But this is the thing.
We're not given any.
I know we're not. Yeah. But you'd assume her parents would have made. They have made a decision. They wouldn't have made one. Like if Salisbury was born with a penis, they wouldn't have said, "Well, let's bring her up as a girl."
No, but I mean, there are people who are born with indeterminate sexual organs.
This is what I didn't. So that's.
And, I mean, she may not be.
What do you mean by indeterminate sexual organs?
Well, there are people who are born with sexual organs of like a hermaphrodite, so you have sexual organs of both sexes.
Yeah. And I thought with hermaphrodites, the parents are given a choice early on whether they snip.
This is often, until recent years, that's often been the case to basically choose a gender and live with it, or rather let your child live with it. But there are various biological conditions where a child can be born without clear genitalia of one gender or the other.
But it fundamentally doesn't matter, because if a person thinks of themselves as gender neutral, that's enough, isn't it?
That is enough.
I mean, they could have girly bits.
They could have girly bits or boy bits and it wouldn't matter. Or boy bits. Yeah.
It doesn't make a difference if they see themselves as gender neutral.
Yeah. And, I mean, this is the thing. So what we do know is that Sal was brought up as a girl and was known as Sally, and that's used as a term of it's a derogatory term by people. They still call her Sally, and he bristles quite a bit. And she now identifies as neither male or female. The book is told in the first person, which quite elegantly negates the need on Westwood's part to assign any kind of a pronoun to Sal.
And that's not a cheat?
It's not a cheat. It's an authorial decision. The fact that Sal is given...
I keep saying things are cheats and you keep saying it's an authorial decision.
I know. It's only a cheat if you break the rules you've set down. It's not a cheat. It was the best way to tell this story without getting readers hung up all the time on pronouns.
Yeah, okay.
Without having an English pronoun that's gender neutral. So, and the fact that Sal's voice is so strong and consistent through this story, it's first person is a perfect voice for this. Because, again, it's noir, right? Noir is often told in first person.
Does this put to lie the idea of a masculine voice versus a feminine voice?
In what sense?
Well, this idea, the idea that some people, that some words are more masculine than others, some words are more feminine than others. The genius of the book is that the words that the way the book is written, you don't get a feeling whether she or he is male or female either. Not to say that the words are very neutral. There's just do you understand what I'm saying?
I do.
Do you remember the controversy last year about using I want more masculine tone or whatever?
Yeah.
So people still think of words as having gender.
Well, they do.
Aside from the obvious words.
Yeah, no, I mean, absolutely. And not just words themselves, but style and content and a whole bunch of stuff. Even the genre that she's – or the tone of the genre that she's chosen to write in, which is very much a sort of noir, sort of slightly sardonic slightly tongue-in-cheek, but also quite – like there's a lot of emotion in there as well,
yep.
Which there always is in the best noir. You'll have the hard-boiled detective who's actually really cares a lot about his case. That itself could be considered to be quite a masculine construct.
Yeah, okay. But I think Kim – somehow navigates it all so brilliantly that it's
well when you
that,
have
that
it,
the writing itself doesn't scream out, well, I'm actually this sort of gender.
And I think when you have a character who is constantly throughout the narrative, because she runs into people and she's having minor kerfuffles and she's constantly reiterating.
So you're using she all the time now.
Well, I know. This is the problem with reading a whole bunch of reviews this afternoon, which exclusively use the pronoun she. I'll try to mix it up a little. So when you have a character who is constantly reiterating the fact that he's not male or female, that he doesn't identify as male. I mean, that just reinforces the tone as being neutral, gender neutral, yeah, in a way, because you have this first person narrative. As I said, the voice of Sal is so consistent. It's a beautiful, beautiful, clean, sardonic voice. It's great, and a voice that's like a character who is he cares deeply for the people in his life, and she doesn't. She's got, again, she's a character with a lot of armor around. Yeah. But
very likable, though.
Absolutely, because we get to see under the armor because we're in her head.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's a good point. And I'm struggling to do a sentence here, not because the book is shit or anything, but because it's just so beautifully written. Yeah. The only problems I had, there were two problems I had.
Yep. And can I guess what they might have been?
Yes.
Because I've been talking to people and the same thing seems to turn up.
What were they?
The first is that there's admittedly a lot of info dumping, especially at the front end of the book. I'm willing to forgive that a lot because of the voice and this voice and this genre that it's put into is expository. That's a part of the genre.
No, that wasn't one of them, but it's hilarious after doing Zoo City and saying how that doesn't do that. I picked up Kim Wiswin in the first 30 pages. It basically is huge scads of info dumping.
Yeah.
But as you are,
info dumping and sort of world building / commentary, which is what
no,
Sal
well,
does.
No, the issue we raise about the, well, not about Zoo City, but about books that do it badly is that they're saying it, but if you were in that world, you'd already know it, so why say it?
Yeah.
So,
except Sal is telling you the story.
Yeah, so look, it worked anyway. Yeah. I didn't have a problem with it. Now, the two issues I had, well, what was the second issue?
Oh, no, the second one is that there, and I don't agree with it at all, but there's some sort of straining of credulity about the actual world itself.
Well, okay, that is my second issue. No. So first issue is that immunization is used.
Yeah, that's
as the thing that causes the pandemic. And
just because of the whole anti-vaxxers.
Well, it's such a sensitive topic. Look, to be frank, it's not belaboured. It's not – this doesn't become a screed on vaccination or
immunization. No, it's just
like –
it was like a
it's
a
just
thing
a nice – it's an SFNL way of getting things. And it actually makes
and you
sense.
Know what, to be honest, I mean the idea is that there was a flu vaccine that has effectively rendered the majority of the population sterile.
Yeah.
That was a thing. But you know what? I think the majority of the population being sterile hands down beats majority of the population being dead from the flu.
Yeah.
Which was, I mean, this was it wasn't just, a bit of a cold and a sniffle.
It's a minor quibble.
Yeah. So.
But if you want a delivery means that's going to cause massive issues, then vaccinations are the way to do it. It's just that there's, if this whole anti-vaccination thing I've got issues with.
It is. Well, yeah, I know, rightly so.
If you vaccinate children.
Of course, rightly so. But I think, yeah, I know. It's a shame that she didn't choose a possibly different vector for
I don't think the book is making a political comment on.
I don't think the book is, no.
No, because it's a very political book, and if it was going to make a political comment on vaccination or immunisation, it would have done that throughout the whole book.
Yes.
But basically here, this is how it happened. Okay, move on. We're moving on
now. Yeah.
So that's a quibble. My second point, yes, is about the world building, but only in the sense that I still can't believe that Melbourne or Australia generally, even if something like that were to happen, would suddenly become ultra right wing and also religious crazy. Yes, I can see.
It doesn't have to be the populace as a whole.
They voted into government.
Sure.
And that's, you've got to vote them in. It's compulsory voting in this country.
Yeah.
So that's more than potentially 50% of the popular vote.
We had John
vote.
Howard for 10 years.
John Howard, and as bad as he was, and I agree that there were issues, is not this. There was no censorship of media. We've still out of fair media, more or less. I mean, there were issues within the media, but that weren't caused by John Howard. Yes, he wasn't supportive of gay marriage. Yes, he thought all transgendered people were, you know, abominations because of, but that wasn't policy within the government specifically.
No.
I mean, we got close with Tony Abbott wanting to ban the RU480, whatever it is. But that wasn't specific policy, though. This is not just, you know, the vagaries of the people in power. This is actual. In fact, prayer is the only thing you can do to get them to become fertile.
Yes.
It's a big step.
It is a big step. And I guess it's harder to picture possibly in an Australian context. I think if I think about a lot of what's happening in the US and a lot of the theocrats. Yes.
But even the Tea Party's losing its stranglehold.
Yeah, but when you talk about control of the media and sort of the drilling down of the media, so you just have sort of this conglomerate which feeds you just the information, the fact that in the US, you know, an atheist is not going to get into government, the separation of church and state and the schisms that are sort of there politically and socially around fundamentalist religion, I think is a lot starker than here, mainly because I don't think most of us give a damn.
Well, that's true.
But even
in America where there is a line drawn between... Yeah,
and we have quite different politics.
In America where there is a clearer line drawn between the religious and irreligious and all that, even there would be a struggle in the current environment. Even with a pandemic that caused what it caused in this book, I can't see them suddenly all becoming rabid... ultra-Orthodox Christians or whatever religion they choose.
Well, they don't all have to become it. They just have to elect people. And
I don't think – I can't see it even in America. I mean, this isn't America. So if it was set in America, it may even be slightly more believable. But in Australia, it just doesn't work for me.
I think you just have to kind of take the leap and see parts of this world building as being a lot of future science fiction as being to some extent allegorical.
Oh, I knew you were going to do that.
What?
Really?
Well, it is.
That can't be the excuse for every time someone doesn't agree with world building. It's an allegory.
Well, no. You've got two choices. You either set it far, far future, or you set it sort of like alternate future. I've not actually read a science fiction novel set previously 2012 that's been any reflection on the time up to the novel.
But did Kim Westwood have to go as far as she does to make the point she wants to make in this book about gender and about and animal rights and a few other things?
Yeah, I think she does.
Really? Did she?
I think it provides a really stark... Well, yeah, but the problem is a lot of people don't think it's very shit right now. I mean, this is the thing. If you're talking about social commentary and political commentary, sometimes you really have to push extremes to go to an extreme that may or may not be entirely feasible as an extrapolation of today, like as we project ourselves forward in 10 years, 20 years, however this is meant to happen. But I mean, this is science fiction. And if you're of the school of thought that science fiction should actually try to predict the future and so on, I'm not saying you are, but yeah. I mean, you know, there are people who think that's science fiction's role.
Yep.
But you know, I'm rather of the idea that science fiction gets to extrapolate. Science fiction doesn't necessarily have to be tied into what is now, what is feasible, what might come tomorrow. In an exact sense. So I'm quite happy to let this play in the idea of a quite dystopic future. I mean, most dystopias, if you boil them right down and try to thread the line from here to there, would kind of break down. The idea is to have this dystopic thing which pushes into allegory, perhaps, but it does so to do it.
I do get what you're saying. You say it so beautifully, Kirsten. Could I be any more patronising? But I don't agree with
you
on this one. Yeah, and sexist. Possibly misogynistic as well. I don't agree with you. And yes, it's based around this concept of science got us into the shit because of the immunisation. It's all science's fault.
And there's a whole bunch of people who believe that.
And there are people who don't drink water here in Victoria because it's got
fluoride
in it. You know, but they're crazy. But they are crazy people. They're not, I mean, Pauline Hanson was one of them. who is in a sense the piss take in this book. The party, the nation,
nation first.
But no one ever thought there was that 2 minutes worth of media fear that Pauline Hanson was going to take over the world, but really no one – the moment she draped an Australian flag around her and did whatever else she did in her – you know, thought she was a cyborg or whatever, no one really took her seriously anymore. And I just don't see it.
But the problem is that you have a look at the people who are in power, you know, right or left, because
– there's no difference. But even if the Mad Monk took over, Tony Abbott took over tomorrow, and there was this sort of pandemic flu.
Well, of course not, because we have a different government. But the point is that government's been overthrown in this book. This is a theocracy.
I don't see where the grass – you need a grass – look, we're going to spend too long on this, and I'll stop now because there's more interesting things to talk about in this book. And I don't want to be one of those
You kind of just have to say, okay, this is what the world is. So – let's look at how people function in this world.
Politics doesn't happen in a vacuum. That's all I'm saying. There are grassroots movements. Things begin to build. It seems like it all happened very quickly and suddenly government got toppled and there were these nutcases in.
We're not exactly given a time scale for this book.
No, but if I'm not mistaken, it must be fairly... Salisbury remembers the time before.
Yeah.
So there was not a whole lot of time. No. She ain't 45 years old in her 90s riding her bike. Going.
But, I mean, if this happened, it would happen quickly. It would happen quickly.
Yeah. I notice there's no Twitter, there's no Facebook, there's no social media in this at all. Did you notice that too?
No, and everyone uses their phones for just kind of calling and texting. There's no
smartphones. No, I don't know if that's because it's very much now a Luddite sort of world.
Yeah, which possibly feeds into that. It might also be, again, if it's kind of an alternate future, it's sort of sidestepped some of that.
Yeah, possibly, although Twitter's been around for... Anyway, maybe, yep, okay.
Yeah.
So, but all of that... is peripheral, to be frank. Yeah. Even though we've just spent 20 minutes talking about it, it's all peripheral because what's really important is the gender stuff. And
well, the social stuff around.
And as you said, gender. By creating an extreme, you shine a light.
You do.
On the disparities that happen in our world now, because that's the point of it. It's not about that's all pretty shit down there, but it doesn't happen here.
Exactly.
No, you go, oh fuck that.
And you don't have to take here. You don't have to take too many steps backwards to get to where we are.
No, you have to take quite a few steps. Yeah, you do, but it shines a lot on the fact that the same inequalities...
In terms of the attitudes.
The attitudes and inequalities are just better hidden.
Yeah, exactly.
At the moment.
Which actually doesn't make them any better for the people who suffer them.
I don't disagree with you. I agree with you 100%. And that's... although, not that this book introduced it to me, but just reading around it, I didn't... What's the cisgender? That's new to me.
That's new to you. That simply refers to people whose gender identity, who they feel themselves to be, whether they feel themselves to be male or female or – well, actually, they wouldn't be able to feel themselves to be androgynous because we don't have that assigned at birth. But it basically matches the way the gender has been assigned.
So I'm a cis man.
Yeah.
And you're a cis woman.
Yeah.
And a trans person is a trans woman, trans man.
Yes.
So basically it's a way of you're putting a prefix on something.
It's a prefix.
Just so everyone's got a prefix.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. So
just equalizing the prefixes out there.
I guess so. It's sort of instead of looking at, you know, the idea of if we take man, the idea of man being this one thing, and if it's not this one thing, which is, you know, born as a boy with a penis and assigned boy, and he feels like a boy when he grows up and he becomes a, you know, if it's not that, then it's something that you just need to qualify with a prefix or something like that. So I guess it just puts gender onto more of a spectrum.
So it undercuts the assumption that man and woman, those terms, are the norm.
Yeah, okay. Which is, you know, what's...
And I think you told me before the podcast, this was around since 94, seriously, I missed the memo on that one because I've only started seeing it in the last few months and I don't know if it's because SFE blogs are starting to use it more or because...
Possibly. I mean, as I said to you, unless you move in circles where gender is an issue and it's discussed, you know, gender politics are discussed, or unless you know people for whom gender is an issue... I don't think it's a term that has yet got mainstream distribution, for want of a better word.
Mainstream distribution, yeah, okay.
I mean, let's be honest. You know, the mainstream is still a gender binary. The mainstream is still male and female. Yeah. And anyone who isn't male and female, like down the line, like, you know, you're born biologically looking like a girl, and when you grow up, you feel like a woman, and you've got no, and you're heterosexual, so you like boys. You know, anything outside of that is considered abnormal.
But if I wanted to be fair in regards to gender politics in this podcast, I'm not taking the piss. No, I'm being serious. because you give me the look. You're giving me the look. Okay. If I was going to be serious in this podcast from now on, and if I'm talking about men and women, I should just say cis men, cis woman.
Yeah, I guess so.
I'm not.
Or you can just say men and women and know that you're including anybody who identifies as a man and a woman.
So it's either I'd use the prefix cis, or I just don't ever say trans something.
Yeah. If you're being specific, you should be specific about everybody.
Or not specific about everybody. Yeah. Okay. Okay. All right. See, this is the thing. This is great about these books that I learn things, because to me it highlights – it's one thing to talk about homosexuality and those gay marriage rights and blah-de-blah-de-blah and all that stuff. But then to have – Kim Westwood specifically does not pick a gay character. She picks a gender-neutral character. So that just changes the whole dynamic in the mind of my – no, who could
gender
be gay?
Identity separate to sexuality. Yes,
but no. Well, I know it is. I know, but
– But here's the interesting – No, sorry. Continue.
Like No. I'm not upset with you. Because I sound like an idiot. But
No. I'm just saying with Sal, because he doesn't identify as a man or as a woman. Like she identifies as androgynous. She has both fem and masculine leanings.
Yeah.
Like. But she doesn't identify as one or the other. So her sexuality – I mean, she has a girlfriend who is quite femme.
Yeah.
But he is not necessarily homosexual, because she isn't – like Sal isn't a male or a female. You know what I mean?
And I did try to imagine their sex scenes because
Kim did.
Well, that's just me. But Kim doesn't really there is sex in it, but they're not graphically – it's not graphically described, so I don't –
No.
So there's none
because
of this.
Sal is a very private person. Sal is a really private character, and that is – so the voice is true to that.
And everyone in the – except for her sister that pops up, his sister that pops up at a point in the story, I'd say 95% of the characters are gender or sexually – transgressive. Is that the
word? They are, because that's the world that Sal tends to move in.
Yeah.
And in this world that Kim Westwood has created, it's illegal to be a gender transgressive.
And I don't give a fuck how broad-minded you are, because I think I'm broad-minded. It is, for me, eye-opening to read a book like that.
Yeah, but well, it's
to be frank, there's no one there I can identify with.
But you don't identify with Sal?
I don't know what gender Sal is.
Does it matter?
It does for my simple mind, yeah.
Okay.
I'm not saying that that's the right thing. I'm just saying that that's how – because when you read, you're creating those images in your head, and all I could see was this weird gender-neutral blank in my head. And that said – God, I knew I was going to sound bad at this. That said, the voice comes out really clearly, but I couldn't put a face to Sal. I could put a face to everyone else, but not to Sal. But there's no one there that I specifically – there's no male heterosexuals in the book that I could
– But do you need a male heterosexual to identify – But no, I'm not a serious question
don't.
Though.
You
but,
don't. Absolutely
but,
not.
But you're saying you kind of do.
No. No. Because I love the book.
No. But to identify with.
Yes.
Hmm. That is interesting.
To have direct identification, yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, what do you mean by direct identification? Like I'm just trying to get – I'm not mocking you. I'm just trying to get to the bottom of exactly what you're saying.
To pretend I was that person.
Oh, see,
to live in their skin.
I find that really, really interesting, and I think
or creepy.
I remember I was talking to I did a reading and my first novel is written from a largely from a male first person point of view. And I did a reading last year and just read a segment of it. And I was talking to a man who came up to me afterwards and said, "Oh, that was really good, and I really enjoyed it, and the voice was really good. And was it really hard for you to write a male character?" And I kind of like looked at him and went, "Are you kidding? Like, do you know what I grew up reading? I literally most of the books I grew up reading were about boys and men.
Yeah.
And with those characters. As a young girl growing up, I had no choice if I was going to enjoy those books but to identify, like put myself literally in the skin of those characters.
Yeah, okay.
So I identified very strongly with Sal. I thought he was great and I in the way you're saying, I could put myself in her skin.
I really struggled.
And you struggled too?
Yeah, I mean, you could argue, well, shit, Ian, this is not the first book you've ever read that's had a gender or something that's different to your own. I mean, shit, I've read plenty of books with female protagonists. But there's usually...
But do you put yourself in there, like the way you're saying?
No, I don't.
So you don't either?
No, but I can relate to them.
Yeah, but you don't...
Put myself in their skin. No,
but you only identify with them if it's a male character.
Oh, no, it's pretty fucking...
That's really interesting.
It's a bit fucked now that I think about it.
No, but I think this is how privilege works, right? Because if you've grown up as a boy...
Yeah.
Mostly reading about boys, and the side characters in those stories were girls. So the girls are always on the side, right?
Yeah.
The main character who you're reading about, who as the reader you're meant to identify with, is a boy. You don't have to stretch what it means to be inside someone who's a bit different to you.
Correct.
Whereas a lot of girls growing up, at least, I mean, I think like it's better now. I look at some of, I mean, it's not great, but. I look at a lot of the books available for young adults now, and there's a lot of female characters, and it's great. And I buy my niece books all the time, and I'm jealous of the books she gets to read growing up as a teenager. But you know, really, when I'm only 38, I'm not like in my 70s, so it's not that long ago. No, but that's what I mean. It's not that long ago.
Yeah.
We're not talking like 50 years ago when they were all about boys. But, yeah, I mean, the books I read in school a lot of the time, they were centered mostly around male characters. So if you're not male and you're reading these books, you are by necessity, if you're going to enjoy reading, and obviously I do, I've grown up to be a writer and a voracious reader, you have to learn to put yourself in the shoes of the male character. But you kind of haven't had to do that.
I haven't, absolutely not. And in fact,
and this is exactly how privilege works.
Only because of this podcast have I had to read more books with women who are front and center.
Yeah, but this is exactly how it works.
I'm beginning to figure that out.
Yeah.
And I want to make it clear to the people who are going to misinterpret me because they're stupid. This book did not make me feel uncomfortable in the slightest. I didn't get all the heebie-jeebies feeling. I felt great, but I did know, and I did feel, whether I'm being a bit patronising to the characters because I felt great sympathy for Sal and her situation, etc., and the sort of world she lives in, but that's because I could do it from a position of privilege. Because in that world, I'm and I just have to, you know.
Well, we both would be.
We'd be bonza.
We'd both be privileged.
Yeah, correct. And I can go, well, poor Sal. Oh, poor society she lives in. And I can feel sympathy on that level. But I don't know if I can delve deep. Oh,
That's really interesting.
Yeah,
and I find that really interesting. I mean, I'm not mocking. I find it really, really interesting.
I can tell the difference in your voice
genuinely.
When you're mocking me, and usually a stick comes out.
It's such a I mean, that's a because I know I can read, which I guess maybe for me the silver wind was more like that. It's more. Whereas you obviously really clicked emotionally with that book.
Yeah.
Whereas for me, I really liked it. I appreciated the writing, but it was, you know, when I'm reading a book, I can get different levels of enjoyment out of it. So there's kind of a spectrum, and the spectrum, I guess, it's a bit messier than a spectrum, but just for illustrative purposes, if you picture emotion at one end and intellect at the other, and so you know, a book you can just really emotionally get into, and you're there with the characters, and you're frightened with them, and you're in love with them, and all of that stuff, and it doesn't matter about how well or badly it's written, it's just got you. And then there's a book that you read, and you may just really appreciate the craft and the wordplay, but there's not necessarily the emotional catch with the characters that the
plot. That's Silver Wind for you.
And Silver Wind, no, it wasn't, not completely, but it was, the Silver Wind is definitely more towards the intellectual, like I did, like especially the Rewind, that story was a beautiful story. But as a whole, I think that collection was more towards me really enjoying it from an intellectual point of view of how Nina Allen had crafted them and how they interacted and just enjoying the cleverness of what she'd done. Whereas I enjoyed The Curious New Bicycle. There was a lot of like crunchy, clever stuff to enjoy about it as well. But I got a lot more emotional resonance out of this book, and that came very strongly with identifying with Sal.
Did you cry and stuff or get emotional?
The bit which got me, which I almost wanted to skim.
What?
The bit with the horses.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I'm just – animal cruelty gets me all the time. It's terrible.
That is a really, really intense scene.
And it's pretty much factual, which is the worst part.
Yeah, I don't really want to I don't want to think about it because that's the problem. We don't think about it and
that's
then
the
it continues.
That is not science. I mean, it's science fictional in
– The horse, the farming,
in the idea that
hormones.
You know, this world's been set up with synthetic and natural growth hormones and all, fertility hormones. But, you know, farming estrogen from pregnant mares is what happens. And the industry is better now than it was even, I guess, 10 years ago. Mostly because the scientists realized that they don't need to use as much estrogen for people as they thought.
Yeah, okay.
So they actually didn't need to farm as much pregnant mare urine as they used to. So it's, but it's still not great. The conditions are still not great, and I'm sure there is still operations which run not much differently than Westwood describes, which is awful.
Is that stuff that we farm today, is that used for IVF and all that sort of thing? And fertility drugs?
It's human growth hormone. Hormone therapy. So menopause, it's big in menopause.
What about? Because I was on human growth hormone-y stuff when I was short.
I don't know what you – this is estrogen. Sorry, it's not human growth hormone. Sorry, okay. That was a misspeak. No, it's hormone.
So I've gone and told people all about the human growth hormone stuff I was on. I didn't need to. Is this what you're saying?
I could cut that out.
No, it's all right.
It's primarily used for menopausal women. Estrogen therapy is obviously also used for trans women. Anyone who needs estrogen, basically. I mean, we do have now synthetic alternatives, but, I mean, Premarin is the biggest.
Okay. You know a lot about this.
I know. I like horses.
Yeah. Do you know, just one other thing.
It's nasty and it I mean, she's described a really extreme kind of.
I'm moving on from the horses.
Okay.
You're upsetting me.
Okay.
Just one other thing. You know what just slightly annoyed me? I wish that Inez had been with her as a partner for the whole novel and there hadn't been the breaking up element, the third. Because I hear a lot about there aren't enough depictions of, and again, then it's not clear whether they're homosexual or not, it's a homosexual relationship or not a homosexual relationship.
Well, it's a gender transgressive relationship.
Yes, a gender
transgressive. Because they're both gender transgressive.
Sorry, there's not enough of those relationships that are depicted. Oh, my God. Depicted positively. And this one isn't depicted negatively, but there is that breakup element. I thought
there's a breakup element, but it's not, as you say, it's not. It's just, it's not. They didn't break up because of their sexuality or their
gender
identity.
No, they broke up because of what's going on in the novel.
Yeah, but, and there's the sense at the end of it
and they get back together
now
again.
That it's all over. They're gonna, it will probably go forward for them well. But I think that's realistic. I love that. I love that. There was this relationship which did get. Because it was a new relationship at the beginning of the book. They hadn't been together for months or even. It had just kind of started. Sal had one date with Inez, remember? And at the beginning.
Yeah, I get that.
So it just started. And then there's all this stress thrown onto it from all of the drama that's happening outside in Sal's life, which directly affects Inez at one point. And a fledgling relationship like that isn't going to. I mean, most fledgling relationships would actually crack.
Yeah, I
under
suppose
that.
You're right.
And
yeah.
But the good thing is that once everything is kind of
like it's
done, and they've come back, which I think is really good. It's a really lovely, naturalistically represented relationship.
Okay, I changed my view. It's not a problem.
Yeah, I am going to have to disagree with you over this.
No, you've convinced me. I've changed.
I think Inez, I mean, this is what's great about it, is that Inez, who's a fairly minor character in the book, I mean, she's very significant emotionally for Sal, she behaves perfectly rationally. She's met this new person who she quite likes, but holy shit, there's all this crap happening and it's dangerous.
Yeah.
I'm out of here.
Yeah.
Because I've not known you for years. I'm not in love with you, Sal. It's just, it's too much. I've got to go. Like, it's perfectly natural response. I mean,
okay,
I really respected.
I take it back what I said.
I really respected Inez. And I love that at the end, there's this sense that that relationship is going to become really significant for both of them.
Apart from that, I loved it.
Yeah, no, I really did. And there's a little info dumping, but I think this book is...
And we haven't spoiled much.
No, I don't want to in terms of the story and the mystery because I think that's... I mean, it's... For me, as I said, it's kind of the lesser aspect that makes
this book. No, but it's actually really good.
But it is really good.
Credit to Kim. I didn't pick all the elements.
No. Oh, I don't mean it's a lesser part of the book, but I mean, for me, on the list of things that I love about this book, the actual plot is quite down there.
Really?
Yeah.
No, I think it's equal.
I really love the characters.
I think she's done a really smart job of working really hard on making sure the plot is equal with the world. Well, really whether you agree with the world building, but with the political stuff that she wants to do in the book.
Yeah.
And,
I agree. It's just I love all the other stuff more.
Yeah, all right.
That's all. It's not in terms of quality. It's just in terms of what I really love about it.
Okay.
And I love Sal. I think Sal is a great character.
I don't want to see a sequel.
No, it's a self-contained book.
No,
I don't want the continuing adventures of Sal's reform. No, please no, Kim.
With werewolves and vampires, just to give it that urban fantasy feel. Wasn't it nice reading a crime noir-y sort of book that didn't have fucking vampires and werewolves and shit in it? That was just a genuine SF book that had...
This is the beautiful thing about this
genuine
book.
SF.
It's a genuine Australian science fiction novel. We don't get that many of them these days.
We haven't said fuck all, really.
No, and it's really good. I mean, it's a dystopic near future. It's set in Melbourne with some cute little... changes, like the street names are changed.
That's the other thing I didn't mention. Her depiction of Melbourne, and she's not a Melburnian.
It's fantastic.
She's not a Melburnian.
No.
So she.
Oh, so she can't write about Melbourne.
No, that's right. She writes Melbourne very well.
She does.
Fisherman's Bend, she got, because I do go there quite a bit for work.
Okay.
She got very spot on. The only problem I had was that she doesn't go southeast beyond Toorak. It's the Toorak. So
well,
Caulfield's not in.
Sal's on a bike, so.
Well, the other side of the Yarra has as much right as Brunswick and Fitzroy.
Oh, God.
Okay? If you're going to depict Melbourne, you're depicting my side of the Yarra. Fuck the Bohemian side.
Oh, come on. We're just a big sprawl over this side.
Yeah,
of the
well, whatever. You should have been upset as well, considering where you live. But all right, fine. Anyway, I loved it.
It's fine. I did. No, I really, really liked it. So I think anyone who's, who has any affinity with the mystery crime thriller genre would really love this book. And then, of
dash
course,
of sci-fi.
Well, then, of course, anyone who's interested in dystopic science fiction would love it. It's such a well-written book, and it was a really surprising change of voice for Kim Wiss. I think this is a very accessible book. Daughters of Moab, I don't think, was that accessible in terms of the language. It was quite a fascinating world and also a dystopic, but further on in the future.
And Cheryl Morgan mentions in her review of the book the Tiptree Judges.
Yes.
Would you expect this one to appear on the – it'll definitely be on the honour list.
I think it would be on the honours list for the Tiptrees. Simply because, I mean, as Cheryl says in that review of hers, it is rare enough to get a mainstream – and this is mainstream. This is Harper Voyager. This isn't, you know, a small boutique press. It's quite – you know, it's rare enough to get characters outside of the gender binary, for want of a better term, running their own novels.
Yep. Okay.
I mean, that's it. Being, you know, heroes in their own story and coming out well. I mean, Sal doesn't get a tragic ending. That's the other thing I love about it. I can't say that enough. It's yeah, she doesn't get a tragic ending. He gets to be with Inez again and it's wonderful.
Yeah.
And that's not really giving it away because the ending is not entirely happy.
But enough said on that. Now, before I completely cough myself to death and lose my voice.
So highly recommended.
So that's that. So we've got to finish up because I will lose.
Yeah, we'll have to forego the rest of the feedback we got from people because Ian's about to hack up a lung here.
We don't have to. We're not going to forego it entirely.
Okay, we're not. Change of plan.
As I said, we got two comments on the website, one from Cam Rogers and one from Mark. They were just little comments and they were very nice and we noticed them and we didn't respond because we don't really respond on the website that much.
I didn't get a notification that we'd had comments.
Neither did I.
I need to check that.
But they were
see
there.
What's happening with that.
We also got a very nice message from Mirror Bay Knight, who's a new person to provide feedback. And Mirror Bay, provide much more. And who actually recommended
that's
a book
a
that we
name.
Might, following our review of Kevin. We need to talk about, not Kevin Rudd, but we need to talk about Kevin. That's a joke that only Australians will get. She recommended another book, which...
It was a Peter Carey novel.
Yeah, it was The Unusual Life of Tristan Smith, which she says is fantastic. Don't know if we'll read it. We might. We may not.
We may.
No promises, but thank you for the recommendation, and we want more. Just because we don't read them doesn't mean we don't want them. But yeah, well, that sounded a bit worse than I was meant to. But,
that certainly
but, no,
did.
But, thank you very much for your and also what you said about Kevin, which I'm not going to read out now, but because seriously, we'll cough through it. But was really good stuff.
Yes. So
yes,
we're going to move on to
the end of the podcast.
The end of the podcast. Oh, this is a bit long. Not as long as last month.
No one complained.
No, that's true. Maybe we should talk for 3 hours.
Then you think people will complain?
Maybe we should talk until they complain.
That's a good one.
Okay. So, next month, special.
No, let's not get to that first.
Oh.
Oh, do you want to do that now?
No. What do you want to do?
No, okay, we'll do next month. Okay, yeah, fine. All right, let's say it. Let's do it.
You say it.
We've got a special guest.
Special guest.
Here's the thing. I'm going to the Adelaide Writers Festival.
I'm going too, but I'm just going to be in the audience.
Can you keep away from me?
Oh.
It's just that I've got my own friends there. I don't really need you to crap my style. Oh. So I'm doing two panels.
I'm going to heckle.
Okay. One of them is the Dalek commentary with Roberto Shearman. Rob's also coming to Melbourne.
Yes.
A week or so, because he's going to the Wellington Writers Festival as well, the week after Adelaide. Then he's coming to Melbourne. And he has said he'd be on the podcast for next month.
Just as well, considering he's staying in my house.
He's got really no choice.
He will be on the podcast.
He will have to be on the podcast, yeah.
Yes, and Rob has chosen a book for us to both read, which is Perfume.
By Susskind.
Patrick
Susskind. Susskind, which was made into a film.
It was made into a lovely film. I've not read the book.
Neither have I. And
I'm looking forward to it. But
we both thought
we
owned the book, but we don't seem to own it.
Maybe they just evaporate like perfume.
Oh,
if you keep them on your shelf for too long, they're
smart.
No longer there anymore.
That's really good. Now, what are you recommending?
I am recommending an older book, a book that I loved when I read it the first time, and I'm going to reread it again for the podcast because it's been quite a while. It's Houses Without Doors by Peter Straub.
That's great.
Which is one of my favourite books of his. I really, really like it. So I'm looking forward to having another reread.
My book has a bit of a story behind it.
Okay.
The second panel I'm doing at the Adelaide Writers Festival, have I mentioned that enough? Has Robert S. Shearman on it as well. I just put the S
Are
in.
Are you just going to be joined at his hip?
I will be man-loving him for a good chunk of that Adelaide Writers Festival and when he comes to Melbourne. So expect to see me a lot here, Kirsten.
In your pants?
No, not necessarily. It depends on what Rob's into at the time.
Okay.
Jules gave me permission. So on that panel will be a writer named Megan Abbott. And it just so happened I happened to have a Megan Abbott book in my house that I didn't know I owned.
Just so happened.
No, seriously, I didn't know I owned. I just saw her and I thought, I'm on a panel with her and I have this book. And the book is Queen Pin, which is what we're going to be reading. So it's just because I thought that I should probably know something about her before I see her at the panel.
Okay. But we'll be doing the podcast after the panel.
That's right. So Excellent. It works perfectly. Excellent. It also means that Rob will have read the book, hopefully, and he'll know something about her as well. Maybe he does. I don't know, I'm speaking for him here. But, yeah, that's Megan Abbott's Queen Pin. It is very short, so people buy it and read it. You'll read it very quickly. But it's crime noir in your face with ladies.
I'm going to leave that alone. Okay, so that's next month. So go out and beg, borrow, or steal. Don't steal. That's
I don't want to spoil,
nice.
But we have a couple of other guests line up in the next few months.
We
special
do.
Special ones.
But we'll be talking
not as special
about
as well. Vaguely as special as Rob. Are those good as Rob?
Oh,
we don't know. Rob
you
isn't,
are terrible.
What? They won't be. Those guests won't be listening. They won't care. Yeah, okay. One of them definitely will be. Yeah, yeah.
Anyway. So.
Yes.
They're the three books for next month. Go and find them, read them, so you can listen in, because there might be spoilers We're not too worried about that these days. In the meantime, you can send us feedback. As we said at the beginning of the podcast, we now have a Twitter account, so you can follow us there and tweet to us if it tickles your fancy.
Why are you saying it like the technology is, you know, plebbies use the tweets? Yep. You can tweet to us. That's how you said it.
You are. You do pick on me. You are sexist.
And possibly misogynist.
It's because I shouldn't talk about tech because I'm a girl, isn't it?
No. You're doing a very good job.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
Would you like to pat my head?
I will later.
Anyway, our Twitter account is Writer and Critic. Follow us. You can also comment at the website, which is writerandcritic.podbean.com, or send us email, writerandcritic@gmail.com. And as always, Ian would like you to know
that I'd expect 5 stars and nothing less.
On iTunes.
Correct.
Excellent. We will see you all in a month.
We will.
And metaphorically speaking.
With the British tones of the Shearman.
That will be a fun podcast. That might go for 3 hours.
Yeah, that that could, it could be a John Richards special. It could
three be, books and Rob Shearman. We are so screwed.
We are.
Might need a bigger hard drive.
Yes. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Are we finished yet?